This is a treat. On the line with us tonight from the Talk Radio News Service is my Air America colleague, Jack Rice. Hey, Jack.
Hey, it's great to be with you, as always.
Yes, well, I don't think we've ever done this together before, so this is really a treat.
Yeah, it's always strange to me, too, because when you and I sort of get together, it's always face-to-face and we're at one thing or another, but to actually do it on the radio at the same time, it's a little bit strange, isn't it?
I know, but it's fun. This is great. So let's talk about what's going on. For me, the big story, I guess, is all the action on the healthcare front. I had Dennis Kucinich on the air for a whopping minute and a half yesterday, right before he introduced his Kucinich Amendment, which passed this morning after a marathon 20-hour markup session in his committee.
This is huge right now in terms of what's really happening. I mean, the bottom line here, and this is really what kind of blew this apart in many ways for both left and right, the Congressional Budget Office came out talking about the cost of all of these proposals, both the Senate proposals and some of the House proposals, too, and essentially said that, you know what, these measures aren't going to save any money. These measures are essentially going to add a new expensive program to cover the uninsured. And so what are you going to do about it? Well, as you can imagine, the Republicans on one side have turned around and said, see, we told you this was coming. And then, of course, the Blue Dog Democrats, those conservative Democrats, are saying, we need to cut more. And then you're going to get the liberal Democrats saying, see, we didn't go far enough. So in many ways, the president throws up his hands today saying, you know what, we need to do something about this. And everybody is staring at each other right now here in the Beltway.
Are they just gridlocked on this now, or are they going to get something done?
No, there's gridlock on this issue. I mean, is there enough push? The bottom line here, and I think the only thing that changes this from 1993 under Hillary Clinton, is that there's a drive from the American people now. And the drive from the American people are saying, enough, there are 46 million people without insurance. There's 50 million more people who don't have sufficient insurance. That's essentially one in three Americans. The number one reason that people are actually going into bankruptcy is because of health care costs. So all of a sudden now, this is being driven not from Washington, but this is literally being driven from Main Street. And the real question is whether or not Main Street is going to win, or the huge lobbyists that have been driving the White House for so many years and driving Congress for an equal number of years. And that's the question that people are literally looking at each other and saying, I don't know.
Right. I had an interview the other day with Congressman John Dingell, and his father was the first to introduce a single-payer bill in the Congress many, many years ago, and he agrees that we need single-payer. But what he said is, right now, in his office, he's getting just as many calls from people on the other side who are saying they don't want health care reform as he is from people like me who think we desperately need it. He said those in favor of health care reform are not screaming loudly enough. We're not making enough noise.
I think that's probably true. And again, clearly my bias is showing up on this. I have seen this in my own life. I've seen this in my own family. The idea that pre-existing conditions could actually stop people from going out and looking for jobs. Heck, I've talked to people who are CEOs of very large corporations. Again, even Walmart has come out saying this is killing us on an international scale. GM has come out saying this. IBM has come out and saying this. I've talked to the governors of at least a half a dozen states. All of them are saying the real problem that they have with their budgets right now are tied to health care costs, because when they talk about education or roads or bridges or infrastructure or just about anything else, health care is one of those costs that's tied to it, and it's killing them too. As a matter of fact, a recent study on this said that health care on average increased by 9.9% last year alone. It was about 10% each of the last 3 years. So as long as my paycheck and your paycheck has gone up by, well, let's figure out the number, 33% in the last 3 years, then I guess we're all good, right? See? It all works out. It's like a warm embrace, isn't it?
I'm still laughing at the paycheck going up 33%. What? Okay.
Paycheck? What paycheck?
Exactly.
Well, right. Come on, how much do you need if you've lost your house, you've lost your insurance, and you're living in a whirlpool box down by the lake?
Good question. Here's the other thing I don't get. The ditto heads out there are still screaming, no, we don't want universal health care. I just got into sort of a flame war on Facebook the other day with some people I used to work at. You know, I was at the progressive station. They still work at the conservative counterpart in the building down the street. And they're saying, oh, God, we don't want that. I don't understand how the Republicans, who are so pro-business, number one, can say they're not in favor of cutting out this extra expense to businesses everywhere. And I don't understand their rationale. And just on a personal level, like me, I have Cobra now. When my Cobra runs out, I'm screwed. I'm not going to be able to get insurance again because I had a malignant melanoma last year. I'll never be able to get covered for cancer. So I don't understand how people can put their own best interests aside, and what they're protecting are the massive profits for the for-profit insurance companies.
It really says something when large lobbying groups and large corporations have been able to convince people to vote against their own interest. And when you talk about your situation with the melanoma, my youngest daughter was diagnosed with epilepsy. Now, I look at her entire life. She will have that diagnosis. Who's going to cover her? What does that mean? I mean, where do I go with that? Where does she go at 16 years old? And you realize that this is happening. Let me give you a sort of a broader scale. This is coming down the pike. People aren't even talking about this one yet. There's a recent study, and I know you talked to this guy because I remember you talked to him. I listened to your show. And you talked to a guy called Food Inc. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, the director of Food Inc.
Okay, now here's the thing about the statistic that was in that I was aware of before, which it still always blows me away, that after the year 2000, one-third of Americans who were born after 2000 are going to develop diabetes.
That's right.
One-third. Now, if that means that one-third of these are going to develop it, and they're developing it younger and younger, and many of them are developing this very thing in childhood now because of the obesity issue, once they develop it and they're diagnosed with diabetes, doesn't that mean that they're out of luck when it comes to insurance? And this is one in three Americans. I'm not even talking about the issue of whether or not you can afford health insurance or whether or not it's even something that you're capable of getting. Now, I'm now talking about a third of Americans who will have a pre-diagnosis that may exclude them from insurance. Contemplate that for a second.
That's right. It's stunning. And the thing is, people wonder, well, how are we going to pay for it? Well, if you cut out the middleman, there's 30%. Everything gets lowered by 30% right off the bat because you're taking the profit motive out of the insurance process. And then on top of it, costs will go down even more because the administrative costs will be lessened when doctors' offices and hospitals don't have to deal with 50 different insurance companies every hour.
Imagine if we were in a situation where we said, I know what we can do. We have an insurance company, and remember, the entire insurance industry does not create anything.
That's right.
The insurance industry doesn't make us healthy.
Nope.
It doesn't solve our problems. It doesn't fix my feet or my head or anything in between. And if they don't actually create or make you healthy or keep you healthy or convince you to be healthy, and all they really are designed to do is to take a maximum amount of profit, at what point do we decide that health is actually, or health insurance is actually a right, and then actually take them out of the mix completely? To me, it's not just a public option. It's actually this question of single payer. See, that's back to this initial debate that said, did we go far enough or did we go too far? The problem is even the public option, to me, is sort of a middle-of-the-road option rather than a single payer, which has actually addressed the issue the way it's being addressed in many countries around the world, and should be.
I agree with you, and that's why what Dennis Kucinich did last night, actually this morning with his amendment passing, is so important because it keeps the single payer idea and option floating. Instead of, if this didn't pass, it would have slammed the door completely on a single-payer option. What the Kucinich Amendment does is it gives states the right to enact their own single-payer plan separate from what the federal legislation is. So it could develop state by state. In fact, in California, the only people apparently standing in the way of single-payer are the governor and the feds and the federal government. So if once this passes, if it's still there in the final bill, that once the Senate and the House get their bills together, if the Kucinich Amendment is still there, then California can independently enact their own single-payer program. And what makes this really interesting is that in Canada, that's how they got single-payer. It started off province by province, and eventually the whole country adopted a single-payer plan.
In some ways, it's reminiscent. A lot of people were talking about what's happening in Massachusetts and how they decided to go down this path and whether or not this could be matched, by the way, which had been introduced by a Republican as a governor.
Right, Mitt Romney.
Yeah, and that's the fascinating part about this. Obviously, that's when Mitt Romney was actually thinking honestly and progressively. Mm-hmm. And then when he decided he was going to run for president, he decided to pander. By the way, I could tell you, it's interesting, is I felt like I made it the other day when all of a sudden I had L. Rushbo actually yell at me on the air regarding something that I said.
Really?
I felt like all of a sudden, as he sat in his Oxycontin-induced haze somewhere with bandoleros of the drug in his basement someplace in Florida, I guess upset about something that I said. So I'm fascinated when something like that happens, and I thought, this is the best he's got? With all the problems in the country, he's going to whine and complain about me? Isn't that amazing?
This guy,
to get some time off or do something for a living. I don't know what he does.
I guess. I think he's becoming more and more of a joke. And I just hope people out there listening see it, too. Because, you know, hearing him rail against Sonia Sotomayor and how she's a racist and how she's a militant, I don't know where he gets this stuff.
Well, you mentioned the Sotomayor issue. Mm-hmm. Again, I've been very lucky this week here in the Beltway. I spent a lot of time watching the hearings themselves. And I can tell you, and I think about this now, you know, as a practicing attorney for quite a few years and watching this really, really, really smart judge, and she's very, very smart. I realized that she was smarter than just about everybody else in the room. And there were a couple who were still pretty sharp that were on the panel themselves, but I found her to be shockingly competent. And by the way, the only thing from my perspective, and again, this is my opinion on this, as I watched her, what I thought to myself is it's too bad that she had to pull back on this question of being the wise Latina. From my perspective, I like the idea that what she brings to the table is an expertise and an experience that brings value and diversity, because I want the Supreme Court to look like the country. I want it to look like Scalia, yes, but also Sotomayor. I want her experience to sort of come to the table in the very same manner that Scalia's experience comes to the table. And everybody continued to talk about how she was this wise Latina as if somehow that's unique, but no one bothered to ask the same question of the white dude. And so I'm a little upset about that issue. I think there was an underlying, I don't know if I want to say racist tone, but maybe ignorant tone.
Well,
is a better description.
But when it came to Jeff Sessions and Lindsey Graham, I would say a racist tone.
Well, you know what? With Graham, maybe not as much to me, but with Jeff Sessions, by the way, that's what Rush went after me about. I said he was pandering to the Rushbo racist, and I believe the term that I used to describe Jeff Sessions was, and please excuse me if this is offensive to anybody, I think I called him a racist douchebag. and I think that's a proper jargon, don't you think?
I do. I think it's fitting.
What he said about the NAACP being both communist and un-American. And then he said, you know, forgive me, and he pulled back. But he literally said the NAACP was communist and un-American. The next day, of course, it was the other night when Michael Steele, again from the RNC, is standing trying to reach out to the NAACP while the head of the Republican side of the Judiciary Committee on the Supreme Court nominee is the guy who called them un-American and communist. What part of racist isn't that?
Yeah, I don't know. And you're right. With Lindsey Graham, maybe racist wasn't the right word, but nasty and condescending describes how he acted.
We can both embrace that with him, without question.
Yeah. And he had the nerve to talk to her about her temperament. Excuse me?
Come on, didn't you love that?
Oh, God.
I thought that was hysterical. I sat there and I thought to myself, look, if anybody's going to have a cerebral hemorrhage in the room, I mean, if anybody's just going to just drop over and bleed out, it's going to be Lindsey Graham.
Yeah.
Come on.
And that would be fun to watch.
If not, it had to be either him or Grassley or Kyle. One of those three guys literally was just going to pop in the room. And I sat there watching them, and I was amazed on how cranky Grassley was. He got madder and madder as the days went on. Actually, I kind of enjoyed that part.
I bet.
That's just me.
Jack Rice is with us. I got to wonder, you know, you've been a practicing attorney. You were a CIA operative. What did you do for the CIA?
I was a case officer. I was a field guy.
Wow.
I was not an analyst. I was a field guy. Now, nobody really knew I was doing that, obviously, until I made the decision to leave. And there's actually something called opening up, where you literally sit down at a desk and they say, okay, here we go, Jackie boy. And we open up all of my files and we say, what shall we say that you did? And we'll talk about the things sort of limit in a limited fashion what it is that I can say, and we build a resume that is not classified, and then I have the right to come out and say, yes, I was this, yes, I was that. And so I'm careful in terms of operations that I was involved in, and so I never talk about those, but I can talk in a more general sense. So when I do a lot of MSNBC, I mean, I've probably made 10 or 12 appearances this week, a
yes,
couple
you
of
have.
And others. But no, I've been very lucky. Trust me, I'm the first one. Remember, my parents never graduated from high school. My brother and I were the first in our entire extended families to ever go to college. So the fact that I'm not working in a bowling alley is shocking, although working in a bowling alley it might actually be a little bit more stable than working in the media business.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you've been an attorney and a CIA field operative, right? What the hell are you doing in radio?
Mental illness, clearly.
I guess.
But see, you've got to embrace that in yourself.
Yes. Well,
You know what it is? I do a lot of reporting on this, and my expertise has led me to go overseas a lot. So I've done a lot of shows, a lot of TV, but I've done a lot of radio because I like radio because it's long form. It's a lot more intimate. I really get to talk with listeners, and that's something I'm really, really proud of. I really enjoy it, but I've been embedded with soldiers in Iraq multiple times. I'm probably going to be going to Afghanistan here very, very soon.
Really?
I've been in Darfur. I was at Guantanamo Bay. I was down on the Turkish-Iraqi border when the Turks were getting ready to invade northern Iraq in a Kurdish city, and this was pretty scary. I was in Palestine. Kosovo. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I've been able to sort of bring an expertise to the media business, which I rarely see, to be honest. And I really like that. My wife thinks I'm a maniac, but she understood the depths of my stupidity when she married me.
Well, that's a good thing. So she gets you. But so drawing on your CIA experience, I just got an email from Jan Schakowsky's office, and she is the chairwoman of the House Intelligence Subcommittee on Investigations and Oversight, and she put out a statement just an hour or two ago that they're going to have a full investigation into certain CIA programs and the Congressional notification process. I know you've dealt with this a lot, and I've been wanting to call you to ask you about this. Your thoughts on what has come to light in the last week about the CIA and the secrets that they kept from Congress?
Well, I'm very pleased that Congresswoman Schakowsky is actually doing this. Again, I've talked to her in about the last week or so myself, and when I talked to her last, what I basically got out of her was, look, I'm looking for subpoenas. That's what I told her. I'm looking for subpoenas here. Will you pursue subpoenas? Because what's important here is to understand what happened. I mean, if we go back and we look at what happened. After 9/11, there was a decision apparently within the Central Intelligence Agency under George Tenet to actually set up a team of operatives that would go out and assassinate al-Qaeda figures. That's how this was set up.
Yeah, and just one second. And people thought Cy Hirsch was crazy when he said Cheney had an assassination team, right?
Yeah, and you know what? You're right. And the thing is I've interviewed Cy multiple times. I've never thought the guy was nuts. And by the way, the reason that you listen to Cy Hirsch, first of all, two Pulitzers. We'll ignore that for a second. Mili, that's his too. But Abu Ghraib, that was his too. The bigger reason, though, every president for the last 30 years has hated this guy.
Right.
Anytime every president, left and right, hates you, you got to be doing something right.
So no, he knows his stuff, and I knew he wasn't crazy either. And when he prints something, if he's going to write it, you know there's something behind it. And here you go; he's vindicated once again. All right.
Absolutely.
So
what we have is this: we have this operation that's set up, and apparently they're in the planning stages, but something is going on. Some training is going on. Lists are being developed. Something is happening. And the reason this is the case is because at least one Republican congressman has already acknowledged that more than $1 million has been spent on these operations. This can't be a bunch of guys sitting around a table drinking cappuccino. It's got to be more than that. Okay, this goes on for some years, but apparently, and this is according to sort of sources that are out there because this is still a classified project, then it gets terminated by Tenet for some reason. Nobody seems to know why. It's then started again by Porter Goss, who replaces Tenet. And it goes on through Porter Goss and is continued through General Hayden. So that continues all the way up to the point that Leon Panetta, the current CIA director, finds out about it and finds out that apparently it was Dick Cheney's office, and either Dick Cheney and David Addington or both, who actually told the CIA, you will not brief Congress on this issue. The real question that's happening right here is exactly what it was that was going on. And the argument that I have been hearing from some is this, and by the way, some of those, including some on the left, not just those on the right, is that because the operations were never took place, they never actually went out and killed anybody, that it wasn't an active operation. My response, and again, I'm also an attorney. So as an attorney, when you think about a bank robbery, or you think about a crime that's committed when you actually decide to rob a bank, I don't have to break into a bank, break into the safe, steal the money, put it in a bag, bring it home, pour it out on the desk, and count it before I've committed a crime. As soon as I actually take one actionable step, I do something that takes me down the path towards committing a crime. I have just committed a crime. That's how it works. So if I get the planning stages and I say, okay, we're going to go after this bank, let's lay it out this way, okay, let's start bringing the people together to do this. If I get even down the path, my response is the operation to break into that bank has already started. In the same fashion, if these guys have gone down the path, and we don't know, but if they have gone down this path and then decide for whatever reason at the last minute to pull back, guess what? That doesn't mean that the operation didn't take place. It just means they didn't complete the operation.
That's right.
That's true. Bottom line, if that's true, then they had an obligation to brief Congress on this issue. And according to all the people I talked to, and this is multiple people, no one was ever briefed.
Right. And here's, I mean, two things. First of all, there's this, the Liberty City 7. Remember that? These poor guys were convicted, and they were just a bunch of, you know, poor black kids from Liberty City, Miami, who were basically set up by the FBI. And they had these grandiose plans to bomb the Sears Tower. They didn't have two sticks to rub together.
Why do you hate America?
Right.
Why do you hate freedom? Right. You know, it's people like you that make us weak.
I know. But anyway, so these poor guys were convicted, and they did nothing. So there's your, you know, starting the process.
Well,
the other thing is...
Think of it that way. Think of that being the standard.
That's right.
How we're going to play this now.
That's right. So, and the other thing is, Congress has direct oversight responsibility for the CIA, and Dick Cheney, as vice president, had no power whatsoever over the CIA. So how the hell can he order the CIA not to brief Congress on their actions?
Well, that's the interesting aspect. I mean, if we think about the organizational structure for just a second, the CIA is actually part of the executive branch. And if you think about the ultimate customer for the Central Intelligence Agency, it's not Congress. It really isn't. The ultimate customer for the CIA is the White House, because the idea is that what you're doing is you're briefing the White House as part of the executive branch. You go out and create things and do things and analyze things and get information, and then you funnel it to the White House. But as part of the 1947 National Security Act, you have an obligation to also brief Congress on these operations. And that's what the law says. It's actually really quite clear. Is there some wiggle room? Yes, but it's part of that operational identification that I was talking about. In this case, however, the idea that you would get Vice President Cheney dipping his beak into the CIA, which he did over and over and over again, by the way, and we've heard about this over and over again, this just simply supports this contention. What he did is he politicized what was going on. He basically said, I am looking for X, Y, and Z. Go find me X, Y, and Z. The problem is what you don't get then is accurate information. You don't get accurate intelligence. What you're looking for is a justification to do what it is that you want, which is exactly what people have been saying now for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And that's the outrage. And yet what I'm getting from Republicans now is what? Oh, it was no problem. Why do you hate America? What's wrong with killing Al-Qaeda? I mean, literally, I have been hearing this. I heard this on MSNBC when I was on yesterday, and I was astounded. It's like, let me see. How stupid are you? I mean, and I'm not even sure what the answer is, because I've seen this over and over and over now. I'm shocked by it.
It is astounding, and that is always the comeback. Why do you hate America? Because they have no response to it that makes any sense. So that's
there's a much better response the next time they tell you this.
Yeah.
All you have to do is say, it's not America I hate. In fact, it's not the war that I hate. I just hate the troops. No, I'm joking. I mean, what else do you say?
I mean, I don't know.
It's a non sequitur, which makes no sense.
That's right.
If that's all you've got, then just give it to them and see if they figure it out.
Right.
They probably won't. I mean,
no.
They probably won't.
No, because they'll go, you do. See, I knew it.
You admitted it. That would be the response.
That's
you're like,
right.
Wow, you really are dumb as a box of rocks.
That's right. Jack Rice, you know, usually this is my quickie news update. You know, I'd say it's a discussion of the news in 10 minutes or less. And, of course, we're going on, but this is too much fun. Is there anything else going on right now that we need to know about this weekend?
Maybe one last thing that happened last night. And I do want to bring this up because I was so incredibly impressed by this. You see, I've followed President Obama since he was in Iowa for the very first caucus, and then I was in New Hampshire for the first primary and across the nation following everybody. And I remember watching this guy, but I watched him in front of the NAACP last night. And as I watched this with so many other people, what I really thought was that what's extraordinary about this guy is not only has he become this symbol where people can say, if this man can move forward and do what he has done, so can I, which thrills me to death. But I also think what he has been able to do, and he did this in a way that I'm convinced there may not be anybody in the nation who could have done this, is to be a sitting president and stand before the NAACP and say, you know what, racism has been really bad for us, and racism still exists. However, we can't use that as an excuse to not do everything in our power to succeed. And what he said was so incredibly inspiring for, I think, everybody in the room and, frankly, everybody watching, that it was really a privilege to watch this thing. And that was really a big story. Maybe it's been missed, but I think it was something certainly that we should highlight.
Oh, great. And I'm glad you brought it up because, honestly, I was working nonstop yesterday and didn't have time. I saw some excerpts of it, but I still haven't seen the whole speech. That's one of my things on my to-do list for the weekend. But so I'm glad you mentioned it because it brought it back to the top of the list, and I definitely will watch it because I've heard it was pretty amazing.
Well, it was a real pleasure anyway. And you know what? I know this was supposed to be 10 minutes, but I was having so much fun, I wasn't even looking at the clock.
Well, me too. We'll have to do this more often.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to it, as always.
Me too. Thank you so much, Jack Rice. Hear him on Air America from noon to 3 every weekday afternoon.